The school year has begun, and like in past years, many kids showed up that first day without many of the basic supplies they needed to learn.
Our kids come with what they can bring. Is it everything? No. Is it the majority of stuff? No, but we make it work.
Making it work is in the DNA of every teacher, but schools and districts are only becoming less equitable, and teachers can't and shouldn't be expected to make up the difference for every child. WUNC spent a year looking at equity in education in North Carolina. We found schools in rural areas still clinging to corporal punishment.
Because down here in the mountains, we do it the old school way.
And we found educators in the inner cities lifting up children in the most difficult circumstances.
And people say we're not smart. She said that we're smart. She always encourages us.
I tell them all the time, put your hands on your brain. Tell yourself, I am powerful, I am smart.
So for the next hour, put your hands on your brain as WUNC looks at equity in education. About 1.5 million students walked through the front doors of North Carolina's public schools on the first day of classes last fall. They brought with them varying levels of curiosity, fears, dreams, nervousness, and hope. About 1/4 of them came from poor households. Almost 2/3 qualified for free or reduced price lunch. According to the North Carolina State Constitution, these students, be they rich, poor, white, or brown, were entitled to receive a, quote, sound basic education. Last year, state and local lawmakers believed that goal could be achieved by providing about $11 billion in funding. That puts North Carolina 43rd in the nation in what it spends per pupil. I'm Dave DeWitt, managing editor for news at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. In the next hour, we'll hear stories from the past year exploring equity in education, using the sound basic education goal as a benchmark. Reporter Jess Clark starts our story with the people on the front lines, teachers. Too often, they have to go to extreme and personal measures to make schools function.
Guilford County second grade teacher Nicole Batts Elder is trying to save money. That's why she's here at the Guilford County Teacher Supply Warehouse. Supported by the Guilford Education Alliance, the shop lets teachers come 4 times a school year to pick out donated school supplies that teachers often spend their own money on. How much does Batts Elder spend?
Out of my own pocket? I don't know, roughly, what are you saying?
She looks across the shop at her husband, Tashane Batts Elder.
Usually around like $500-$600 in a year.
And that's not unusual. Recent national surveys have shown teachers spend an average of $500 to almost $1,000 a year out of their own pockets to stock their classrooms.
I try to do better year to year where I'm not spending so much, but it never works out. Anything from baskets to border to notebooks to pencils to tissue to pencil sharpeners. I mean, just little things, even shoestrings that we keep, like if you lose shoestrings out of your shoes and you don't have shoestrings.
A lot of these are supplies schools run out of or things that students are supposed to bring but show up without. Batts Elder works at Cone Elementary, a Title I school where the majority of her kids come from low-income households.
Our kids come with what they can bring. And is it everything? No. Is it the majority of stuff? No, but we make it work.
To make it work since the recession, teachers and schools have had to dig deep. Not only are families less able to afford classroom supplies on their own, but North Carolina schools are less likely to have the funding they need for classroom materials. In 2011, state lawmakers cut funding for school supplies in half, from about $60 per student to $30. Next year, classrooms will see about $40 per student. Sherry Schleser is principal at Kingswood Elementary in Wake County. She says when state funding went down, school expenses didn't go away.
So instead of just being able to take care of everything ourselves, we've had to seek help from the outside.
By the outside, Schleser means donors, foundations, PTAs, individuals, churches, corporations. Those organizations are covering a lot of her school's expenses for basic classroom supplies. Even so, Schleser says teachers are still spending out of pocket, especially as hands-on projects become a standard part of the 21st century curriculum.
Children learn best when they have their hands deep in their learning. They're physically involved in developing concepts. And without those extra supplies that the teachers are buying. And sometimes it's straws or cups or string.
Or styrofoam or rocks or even 2x4s. Some North Carolina teachers have been able to fund classroom projects through crowdfunding websites like Donors Choose. But Schleicher says finding classroom funding shouldn't be on the backs of teachers. It should be on the state. At the Teacher Supply Warehouse, Bats Elder says she's grateful the Guilford Education Alliance has picked up some of the slack.
Does that mean I won't have to go out and spend money? No, I already have, and I'm probably not done. I haven't gone back and started setting up my room yet, so it's just, I'm sure that I will.
After all, soon her classroom will be full of second graders. Some will come with sparkly pencil cases and Pokemon erasers. Others might not even have shoelaces. But it's up to Bats Elder to make sure that by next August, all of them are ready for third grade.
Teachers hardly make enough money to spend a lot out of their own pocket for supplies. But Jess Clark has another story of other school employees who are often left out of the conversations about school equity altogether.
In the parking lot at East Cary Middle School, bus driver O'Murrell Wright walks down the aisle of her bus between rows of empty seats, checking the alarms and the emergency exits. She does this before each trip to make sure her ride is safe, and she knows the exact minute she can expect the first students to climb aboard, 2:13. Wright says she's always been punctual.
I have. I have. Ever since I was little, yeah. I am, when it comes to being on time, I'm very, very strict about that. That's just one of my pet peeves is being on time. And my kids know that.
Wright says she loves driving kids to and from school. But there is one thing lacking, the pay. Wright started out at just under $12 an hour. Now, after 10 years on the job, she's making just $13.75.
I feel like it's not fair because as long as I've been here, I feel like at least somewhat of a raise would be good every year, especially with me having two kids and having them on my health insurance. And like with my health insurance, that's the majority of my check, just about.
It's not quite the majority, but it is a big chunk. Wright says she takes home about $1,300 a month. About a quarter of it goes to pay for her family's health plan. That leaves her with less than $1,000 a month to pay for rent, utilities, and food for herself and her two girls. Impossible to manage if she didn't have a partner helping her out financially.
And I'm very thankful because if I didn't and I didn't have a supportive family, I would probably be living in a one-bedroom with two kids.
Wright's partner is also a bus driver. He has to work a second job in retail to make ends meet for their family. And bus drivers aren't the only school employees earning poverty-level wages. David Nieder is chief financial officer for Wake County Schools. He says more than half of Wake's non-instructional employees are earning less than $15 an hour, even after decades on the job.
A teaching assistant who would start out at $11.80 an hour would not hit the $15 an hour rate until they were here 27 years.
The salary schedule for school employees is set by the state, so the low wages aren't unique to Wake County. Some districts like Wake supplement the state's salaries with local taxes. Nieder says the state usually gives employees annual raises, but state and local budgets became tighter during the recession.
And as a result of that, there were no raises during that period of time. But even after we got out of the recession and with a growing economy, there were either no or limited increases for these people. So that's really created a compression that's exacerbated that what was already in place.
Nieder says the pay schedule is not only hard on employees, it also makes it extremely difficult to recruit and retain bus drivers. Wright says she's sticking around because she enjoys her job, but many of her former colleagues have left for better pay.
With Wake County, it's like a revolving door.
Bus driver recruitment is one reason why Wake County School Board Vice Chair Monica Johnson-Hosler wants to increase the district's minimum wage to $15 an hour. But she says it's also about taking care of all the district's employees.
And when I say take care of, I mean these people are working. We're not giving them anything that they're not earning. I'm just advocating that we remotely start to touch the conversation of paying them what we think people's time and efforts are worth, especially those folks who are engaged with our most prized possession, and that's our children.
Nieder estimates getting all employees to a minimum of $15 an hour would cost the district tens of millions of dollars and would probably take a number of years. Johnson Hostler says she's hopeful she can get public support in Wake County for the raise, but she says ideally the state would boost pay for employees in every district.
Even in the best of times, many schools in North Carolina face chronic and persistent underfunding. But when disaster strikes, the terms sound and basic take on a whole new meaning. Just a few weeks into the 2016 school year, Hurricane Matthew hit one of the state's poorest school districts, making the long climb to be fair and equal even steeper.
At Robeson County School Central Offices, Superintendent Tommy Lowry points to a large hole in the top of the chain link fence.
Where that fence is cut there, that's where I came across in a boat. That's how high the water was, and we came across there in the boats when we came in here.
Do you want to look at the list and then give me a call back as to what you think you want to get rid of?
Now the water has receded, revealing the extent of the damage, which is nearly total. In blue jeans and work boots, with a cell phone attached to his ear, Lowry picks his way over the slick, muddy floors and piles of waterlogged office supplies and warped furniture. He wears a mask to protect himself from the toxic air, so foul it turns your stomach.
You find the same kind of damage everywhere. This is a new desk that was just put in here. You can see how it just picked up everything and just destroyed everything.
What goes through your mind when you look at this?
Just thankful, because it could have been worse, I think. I don't know how sometimes, but I think it could have been worse.
Lowry says he's grateful none of his employees or students lost their lives in the flood. So far, the state counts 25 people who died as a result of Hurricane Matthew. But the damage to his school system is well into the millions. The district's central offices, print shop, textbook and supply warehouse, and maintenance equipment are destroyed. So are nearly all of the student and personnel records, going back decades.
The only records we'll be able to save are the ones that were in the top shelf. All the other three file cabinets, those records are gone.
Lowry has been working 14-hour days since the storm hit, trying to figure out how the district can get students back into the classroom, especially those who are now homeless.
A lot of our kids have gone through, horrendous situation that they've been through. And I think at our schools that we can provide the counseling, we can provide the nurturing that they need to, you know, kind of put their lives back together through the situation they've gone through.
Several miles away, families are still using South Robeson High School as a shelter. Charlotte McCollum and her 5-year-old granddaughter, Jariah, are outside getting some air. McCollum says she's doing her best to keep Jariah's mind active while the schools are closed.
I find books, like for shapes, colors, where she could practice writing her name, her numbers, stuff that she do in kindergarten. I found it in here. She does her homework. Like I said, I don't know about the rest of the kids in here, but Jariah Chavis, she do her homework.
McCollum's family is sticking it out for temporary housing in Lumberton. But FEMA has relocated some families to hotel rooms in Fayetteville, almost an hour away. Other students have left the area to stay with family members in other parts of the state. If those students don't return, it could have a financial impact on Robeson next year. Pamlico School Superintendent Lisa Jackson knows what Robeson is going through. She says her district near New Bern lost about 10% of its students after Hurricane Irene in 2011.
That's a huge impact on a small district where every student is funding dollars for us, too, to be able to get the things that we needed.
Enrollment losses aren't top of mind for Robeson officials, at least not yet. Right now, the focus is getting the classroom doors open. Jackson says, based on her experience, that's as it should be.
Get those kids back in school as soon as possible. Make things normal for those kids, at least during that 7 hours that they're in school. And they will be okay. They will get through it. Years and years later, you know, there'll still be things that you'll be dealing with, but you will get through it.
Friday makes 2 weeks Robeson students have been out of school. District officials are hoping to get students back into the classroom before November.
Robeson County reached that goal as kids got back into classrooms within 2 weeks. But many of the families are still living in FEMA housing 10 months later. After a break, a variety of schools try to rise to the challenge of providing a sound, basic, and equal education to every North Carolina student. This is Equity in Education, a documentary looking at imbalances in North Carolina's public schools. I'm Dave DeWitt. Every day in classrooms across North Carolina, students and teachers overcome remarkable odds. Sometimes that means being the first in a family to graduate from high school. For others, it means earning a college scholarship. Tucked between a destination park and Central Prison in Raleigh, the Governor Moorhead School is North Carolina's only residential school for blind students. And as WUNC's Lisa Phillip reports, success here requires a sustained and unwavering effort from not just students, but entire families.
17-year-old Antoinette Ray is trying to vacuum her dorm room without bumping into anything. For the high schooler, the task isn't just a chore.
If I want to live by myself, I'm going to have to learn how to vacuum my own floor without somebody being there.
Antoinette lost her vision at 13 as a result of glaucoma.
Not having vision and learning how to do things in a different way was scary because I was thinking more, how do other blind people accomplish what they want to do with having no vision?
Antoinette says she felt isolated at her neighborhood public school. She was the only student there with a visual impairment. A team of educators at her school district suggested she attend Governor Moorhead School, North Carolina's only state residential school for the blind. The K-12 school is located in Raleigh, an hour away from Antoinette's home. The teen stays in one of the school's dorms during the week and visits her family in Burlington on weekends.
When I first started here, I was very homesick and I didn't want to be somewhere without my parents. Now that I've gotten a lot older, it's cool.
Antoinette has learned to do everyday tasks by herself, like cooking, cleaning, and walking around campus. This is as important as academics for visually impaired students, says Laura Wooten. She's director of student life at Governor Moorhead School.
Each child has a goal sheet where we identify areas that they need assistance in helping them to live as independently as possible when they leave Governor Moorhead School.
That means going step by step with students through skills that sighted individuals take for granted, like tying shoes or using microwaves.
There are several students, it's not just a visual impairment that we're dealing with. There's some learning cognitive issues, and even with that, we're able to meet the student, you know, on their individual level.
For Antoinette, being an individual means competing on her school's cheerleading team.
Let's do it! Ready? Okay!
At my middle school I used to go to before I got here, I was not able to cheerlead because I was visually impaired. So I figured if I see other visually impaired students at Governor Moorhead cheerleading and doing track and goal ball, then why can't I do it?
Despite the wraparound services Governor Moorhead provides, its enrollment has dropped dramatically in recent years. Dr. Barbara Bacon, the school's director, says it's partly because fewer kids are now born with visual impairments. But she also says larger urban school districts are hiring their own support staff for blind students.
So they're able to actually stay in their neighborhood schools and receive the services.
This year, Governor Moorhead is educating between 55 and 60 students at a cost of $5.6 million.
People look at what it costs to send a child to the state school for the blind versus the per pupil cost of sending him down the street. It leads people to the opinion that it's too expensive to send the child to the residential school.
As a cost-cutting measure, legislators have proposed closing the school more than once in the past decade. But Bacon argues the expense is a worthwhile investment.
If they can't figure out what to wear when they get up every day, if they can't get themselves dressed, if they can't fix them something to eat for breakfast and then realize what they're going to do for lunch or dinner, if they can't get out of the house to go to a job.
Then, Bacon says, taxpayers foot the bill for supporting these individuals from the time they leave public education for the rest of their lives.
Like many states, North Carolina is banking on the benefits of digital learning. 4 years ago, lawmakers passed legislation requiring that state funding for textbooks be replaced by funds for digital materials. The deadline is this summer, but hundreds of thousands of kids don't have access to high-speed internet at home, and that could create a digital chasm that might take decades to cross. Lisa Phillip reports.
Driving into Warrenton, North Carolina is like stepping back in time. The town of 800 or 900 is filled with centuries-old housing, churches, and storefronts. Step into its elementary school, and you'll rejoin the present, or even catch a glimpse into the future. In a back hallway in a fifth grade classroom, each student huddles over a Chromebook. They're using the devices to answer questions about a story with occasional help from their teacher.
But in this case, the baby elephant is taken to the orphanage because what happened?
Because she was dying.
What happened to her mother?
The mother was killed.
By?
The police.
Yes. A lot of people assume that when you take technology into the classroom, the teacher is out.
Fifth grade teacher Cheris Shattuck says this isn't the case.
A lot of the apps that I use or the programs that I use allow me to go and see their work live, and I can shoot them feedback, or as I'm walking around the room, I can help them.
But what about when Shattuck's students go home? Ernest Connor Jr. is director of technology for Warren County Schools.
As we move more towards a digital age and, you know, the story with the digital textbooks and, you know, the digital resources, when students are at home, some have access and some do not. So all of our students are not on the same playing field.
40% of Warren County households lack high-speed internet access. That's according to the FCC. Ray Spain has served as superintendent of Warren County Schools for 14 years.
When students have access, there's a certain amount of curiosity. There's a certain amount of freedom to explore new and different things, and they need that.
Manakin Harris is a manicurist in Warrenton. The mother of two says she used to have broadband.
The problem was that the bill got high, you know, and it was a financial thing, you know, for me to keep it up.
Harris says the service costs $54 a month. Per capita income in Warren County is less than $20,000 a year.
It would make it a lot easier to have it at home. Because me, with my kids, I love to help them with their projects, especially when it comes to research. I love doing that.
Harris says she knows many Warren County residents who wouldn't be able to sign up for broadband even if they could afford it. It's not profitable to lay broadband cable in rural areas without many potential customers. Superintendent Spain says this is where government needs to step in.
Just as we have now that parents and families have a right to running water in many cases, have a right to telephone service, and have a right to electrical service. They ought to have a right to internet service. It's a basic utility, and it's a basic, it should be a basic right because so much depends on it.
Warren County is currently surveying its residents to see who does and doesn't have broadband access. In the meantime, Manakin Harris is working on reconnecting her home for the sake of her older and younger daughters.
By her going to high school, she's going to need it. And, you know, I have a four-year-old. So by her starting kindergarten, I know she's going to need it because, you know, they start kindergartners out into computer in the computer world. So I know she's probably going to need it too.
Technology, while a barrier for some, also has great potential to reach students who struggle in a standard classroom setting. That's part of the thinking behind virtual charter schools. But as Jess Clark reports, best intentions are so far falling well short of even basic standards.
It looks a lot like Saturday morning at the Thompson household in Johnston County. Three girls are in comfy sweats at the breakfast table or kitchen island, each slouched in front of a glowing laptop. But this is 11 a.m. on a Monday, and while the Thompson girls aren't in a classroom, they are in school.
This is a less stressful situation because you kind of see how laid back they are. They're not being rushed to hurry up and finish this.
That's the girl's mother, Tammy Thompson. Last school year, she enrolled her three kids in North Carolina Virtual Academy, or NCVA, one of the state's two virtual charter schools. Thompson worked as a child nutritionist for 15 years in Harnett County Schools, and she says she thought the environment felt unsafe and that kids weren't getting the attention they needed.
We had a foster child that lived with us, and I met her in the sixth grade at my school, and she couldn't even read, and nobody figured it out. I figured it out. She couldn't read, and she had made it all the way to the sixth grade not reading.
At the breakfast table, 8-year-old Abigail Thompson clicks lightning fast through multiple choice math problems. She says other kids picked on her when she went to a regular public school. The virtual experience, she says, is much better.
You don't have to get bullied and you still can make friends.
Mm-hmm. Do you still make friends through your school?
When we have open chat, we can either chat to our friends through the chat box or through the microphone.
Not all virtual charter school students are doing as well as Abigail. The state's two virtual charters, NCVA and NC Connections Academy, fell far short of expected student growth on state tests. In fact, the schools have the two lowest student growth scores in the entire state.
Are our scores what we wanted? They're not, but we're going to improve.
Joel Medley is the top administrator for NCVA. He says the school has added more staff and created small groups to help students who struggle in math. When it comes to the low growth score, Medley says he looks at growth differently.
If you talk to those families, the statements that they are giving us about the schooling that they received this year compared to where they have come from, that's the difference. That's part of the growth. If you have students that are behind, you can't turn them around completely in 1 year. It takes time. And that's all that we're saying is give us the time with the 4 years.
4 years is the amount of time the North Carolina legislature approved NCVA and Connections Academy to run. Lawmakers call it a pilot program. But pilot or not, the program makes for an expensive experiment. The two schools have collected more than $15 million in taxpayer funds, and they have more than 3,000 students statewide. Todd Zebarth is with the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. He says that's a lot of kids to have on the line in a pilot program.
Those numbers are probably too high, at least out of the gate. Why don't we see if these operators can succeed maybe with a few hundred kids?
Zebarth says he thinks the main reason operators are starting out so big is because they want to make more money. After all, these are for-profit companies running these schools. The operators also hold sway with state lawmakers. K-12, the company that manages NCVA, has 5 lobbyists registered with the state. By contrast, the State Department of Public Instruction has 1 lobbyist.
What great English explorer and sea captain, Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake.
But Tammy Thompson says NCVA's for-profit nature doesn't bother her. Neither do its low test scores, even though one of her kids tested below grade level last year.
It doesn't bother you that the scores, the state scores are low?
No, the testing is not. I see what my kids do daily. That test does not say who my kids are.
Under the terms of the pilot program, the schools can grow 20% each year, and both schools say they intend to do so. That means next school year, the two virtual charters could enroll more than 4,000 students.
The state of North Carolina is more than 500 miles wide, and the experience of students in the far eastern and western ends of the state can be quite different. But in at least one way, it's very similar. Students in Robeson County in the far southeastern part of the state are subject to corporal punishment or paddling, just like students in Graham County along the border with Tennessee. WUNC's Jess Clark reports that a practice that seems unthinkable in Raleigh or Charlotte is still accepted in some of the state's most close-knit communities.
Robbinsville High School sits in a small gap in the Smoky Mountains. Green slopes dotted with a few cattle hug in around the school before they rise into a thick cover of pine trees. If there's one word to describe this area, it would be isolated.
So this is like really in the mountains here.
It is really in the mountains, yes.
David Matheson is principal of Robbinsville High School, and he's the only high school principal in the state that still uses corporal punishment. At Robbinsville, corporal punishment takes the form of paddling, a few licks on the behind with a long wooden paddle delivered by Matheson. Last year, he paddled 22 students. The school's policy allows students to request a paddling in place of in-school suspension, or ISS. Matheson says this practice keeps students in the classroom.
Most kids would tell you, they choose the paddling so they don't miss class. And even though they get their work in ISS, it's still not like being in the class, in front of the teacher.
Robbinsville senior Allison Collins says she chose to be paddled her sophomore year after her phone went off in class.
That's like my first time ever being in trouble.
Collins went to the assistant principal's office where she was told she had a day of ISS. Collins told Principal Matheson she'd rather take a paddling, and Matheson called her father to get his permission.
And my dad was like, just paddle her. Because down here in the mountains, we do it the old school way.
Matheson says he only paddles a student if he gets permission from the parent. And he says very few parents opt out.
And I think that's one of the reasons maybe so many parents are good with it. You know, it's not something that I'm saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do. It's how I'm going to deal with your child. It's something that the family decides.
Matheson leads me to the band room, where Robbinsville parent Sherry Lynn is substitute teaching.
Oh, no, you found me. Yeah.
Lynn says she and many other Robbinsville families support the use of corporal punishment in school.
I think it goes back to traditional values. A lot of the parents still hold to the traditional values of corporal punishment. They use it at home, and so the school is an extension of home.
In a small, isolated, and tight-knit community like the one in Graham County, it's not hard to see why families might have more trust in their school administrators than families in other districts. Matheson says he went to school with a lot of his students' parents. Still, not everyone at Robbinsville is on board.
Well, I've got a couple student teachers down here. They might offer a little bit different perspective. Hey guys, how are you?
In a classroom down the hall, we come on student teacher Bo Cronland. He's taking a breather between classes. Cronland says he's not comfortable with the way the school uses the paddle.
Last semester, one of my freshmen did get spanked, and that's how I knew they did corporal punishment here. So I was like, oh no, like, I'm not incredibly for it in school, depending on kind of just what the mishap is, because you got spanked for just talking in class. So I'm just kind of like, kids talk. So I don't think they should get spanked for it.
There are decades of research showing corporal punishment leads to bad outcomes for students. Higher dropout rates, increased rates of depression and substance abuse, and increased violent episodes down the road. Matheson says he's seen that research, but he still believes paddling is an effective form of discipline.
I feel like if it was still used more often in our schools, we'd have a whole lot better society. I do. I believe that.
Graham County isn't the only community that supports corporal punishment in schools. More than 300 miles east, we trade mountain forests for the flat, sandy lowlands of Robeson County. Venus Maynor is in his driveway, working on a truck he owns for his waste removal business. Maynor has a 10-year-old son who goes to school just down the road at Prospect Elementary. Last year, Prospect staff paddled 31 students. Maynard's son, Ori, got paddled in the second grade.
He and another little fella were running outside of the line. And the teacher, she pulled him back in line and told him, says, hey, we're gonna paddle you for not doing what we asked you to do. And, of course, she made good on her promise. She paddled him when he got back to the room with a witness, he and the other little boy. And when his mother picked him up, the little boy that was in trouble with him says, Miss Cicely, Ori got a paddling today. Me and him got a paddling.
Maynor says he believes paddling or spanking is an important part of raising a child. He points to a tall tree along the edge of his property.
If you go to that big pine tree over there, that mature pine on the ditch there, you can't do anything but cut it down. There's no sway in that tree. You can't make that tree do anything but just either cut it down or just steady grow. And if you start early with that sapling there, if you need it to go to grow that way, you can tie a string to it and pull it, and it's going to grow the way you tie the string. And in respects to raising a child, it's the same way.
It's not unusual for parents to support the use of corporal punishment as a form of discipline. Recent surveys show about 75% of Americans believe it's sometimes necessary to spank a child. What is unusual is that these parents support corporal punishment in school. That's where Tom Vitaglione of child advocacy group NC Child takes issue with the practice.
When it gets to the schools, we now have an agent of the state hitting a child. And we don't believe that should happen and that cultural issues should not override that perspective.
It's safe to say most parents at Prospect Elementary or Robbinsville High School don't see school staff as agents of the state. These are both unusually tight-knit communities. Graham is one of the most geographically isolated counties in the state. And Prospect Elementary is a majority Lumbee Indian school in the state's oldest and most established Lumbee community. Maynor, who is Lumbee, says he has a rare degree of trust in Prospect Elementary School staff.
Yes, I do. I trust the teachers and the principal to, you know, do what's right.
Still, even in these two communities, paddling is on the decline. In fact, last school year, both districts cut their number of paddlings in half. NC Child's Vitaglione and other child advocates would like there to be zero paddlings. They're asking state legislators to outlaw the practice in schools for good.
Coming up, our comprehensive look at equity in North Carolina's public education system continues as we step outside the traditional school buildings. This is Equity in Education, a documentary looking at imbalances in North Carolina's public schools. I'm Dave DeWitt. Education and education inequality starts in the classroom. There are numerous examples. Teachers in wealthier districts make more money in North Carolina. PTOs raise more money in wealthier districts. But it's also true that what happens outside the schools plays a significant role in learning inside the classroom. Take, for instance, dental health. In wide swaths of North Carolina, children don't have access to a dentist. Lisa Phillip reports on one effort to address that problem.
Up and close. There we go. So you can be in charge of that, right?
Two third graders from New Hanover County are visiting the dentist's office parked behind their school.
There you go. So you hold that in your left hand and you're in charge. So if you get too much water or toothpaste in your mouth, just put it in there and close your lips around it, okay?
The boys get to pick Netflix movies to watch during their visit. They don't seem to notice the x-ray machines or dental implements crowding the 50-foot trailer.
So, any trouble with any routine? Nothing been bothered.
This is the Miles of Smiles mobile dental clinic. It's operated by the New Hanover and Brunswick County Health Departments. It stops at 19 schools a year to screen and treat children on Medicaid for free. The mobile unit has served nearly 5,000 children since it opened in 2006. For many, climbing aboard means their first visit to a dentist. Dr. Zachary Hunter is in his 10th year with the clinic.
Especially in Brunswick County, where it's a little more rural, you know, it's so far to go to a dentist over there because the county's so big and everything's so spread out. A lot of times, we get to see a lot of first-timers.
The American Dental Association recommends children see a dentist no later than their first birthday. But general dentists, let alone pediatric dentists, are few and far between in rural North Carolina. Dr. Alec Parker says that's because dental practices need a certain number of patients to stay afloat. He's director of the North Carolina Dental Society.
So if you look at where the dentists are in this state, they're mostly where the people are, which kind of makes sense.
Of course, the Charlotte area, Greensboro, Chapel Hill, Raleigh.
Dr. Jessica Lee is dean of pediatric dentistry at UNC Chapel Hill.
And then you see some kind of what I would call areas that just don't have any provider.
Three rural North Carolina counties lack any active dentists, according to the latest data. More than 20 others are served by two dentists per 10,000 residents or less. To make things more difficult, not all dentists accept Medicaid. This puts low-income families living in rural areas in a bind.
We have kids, you know, every day that drive 2-3 hours to come see us here at Chapel Hill, which is still shocks me today, you know, being on the faculty 15 years, that they would drive that far to come access care.
Getting this care matters, Lee says, even for kids who still have their baby teeth.
I can't tell you how many times we've had parents come in and said, you know, and their quote is, "I just didn't know. I didn't know that this could happen to my child. No one told me that it could happen to my child, that my three-year-old could get so many cavities and even get sick from them."
Back on the Miles of Smiles bus, hygienist Leslie Houston puts the finishing touches on a student's top teeth.
Tipping your toothbrush towards your gums so you can get all those pesky little places that the sugar bugs like to hide, right?
Earlier in the morning, Houston saw a 5-year-old with two cavities, one of which was infected.
I mean, we have nurses that are waiting for us to get to the schools to take care of the kids that need work.
Fortunately, Houston says, annual visits from the dental bus seem to be helping.
So they're not in the nurse's office constantly with a toothache or a problem. So that's big.
That means kids are spending more time in the classroom learning and hopefully smiling too.
rising to fill gaps, often created by a lack of funding or access, happens all across North Carolina. And with increased focus on STEM education, even wealthy districts and urban areas overlook the importance of arts education. Lisa Phillip has the story of college students teaching young kids the value of music.
Joshua Pong-Sitipon is approaching this new piece of music with a healthy mix of caution and confidence.
How you feel?
Difficult.
I think it's difficult. Do you think it's achievable?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Give me a week.
I'll give you a week.
His piano teacher, Catherine Batchelor, knows how to encourage the 15-year-old. She's been teaching Joshua and his younger brother, Josiah, for nearly 7 years.
It's been really neat to see how much they've grown. They've really honestly outgrown my ability to teach them.
Weekly piano lessons over the course of 7 years could have cost the family anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000. With help from Chapel Hill Nonprofit Musical Empowerment, they paid nothing. The organization recruits college student volunteers to teach free private lessons to kids.
If we have to spend money, maybe we cannot send them to the class like this.
That's Joshua's father, Jimmy Shui. He is a member of an ethnic minority persecuted by the military government of his native Burma. He and his wife fled to the U.S. with their sons about 8 years ago.
As the refugees family entered to this country sometime, our financials also not very good. So when they offer the cost like this, the class like this, it can also help us too. We don't need to spend much money.
Meredith Richards is the executive director of Musical Empowerment.
Private music lessons is really a privilege. They're very expensive and time-consuming, and so, you know, there's a huge gap between, you know, the kids who can take paid private lessons, and most kids from low-income families cannot afford to have a private lesson teacher.
Students are referred to Musical Empowerment by elementary and middle school social workers and teachers. Since its founding 15 years ago, the organization has grown to include more than 130 student-teacher pairs. Ann Dahlman has sent several of her students to the program. She teaches orchestra at Phillips Middle School in Chapel Hill. She says many of her students can't afford private music lessons.
I can imagine what it feels like to be in a position where you see children who have everything and you don't have those things available to you. And just it would be kind of defeating to feel like, well, I can never be as good as them because I don't have these things in my lives. And
Dahlman talks about a little girl who came to her class knowing how to play the violin through Musical Empowerment lessons. But the student had some difficulty in school.
She just had gorgeous bowing, which makes such a nice sound, and that's from her lessons. And so when I told her, can you model your bowing for the rest of the class, she looked shocked, like, you want me to do something to show the rest of the class? And from that day on, she's like had a real confidence in orchestra that, you know, I think hopefully has helped her to be more confident in her other classes.
So let's practice it.
Music has inspired a similar kind of confidence in Alexa. The fourth grader has been taking violin lessons with a Musical Empowerment volunteer for 3 years.
I'm happy that I have lessons because if I didn't have a violin, I feel like I'd be so stressed out.
Allows you to be creative, maybe? Yeah.
Makes me think I can do anything in the world.
One, two. Good job.
Musical Empowerment recently started chapters at Wake Forest University and NC State. And the program's executive director hopes to expand the nonprofit's low-cost model of music instruction to other campuses in upcoming years.
A harsh reality in public education in the 21st century is this. Music and arts education is nice, but it's end-of-grade tests that matter. Without adequate scores and/or growth, teachers and administrators can be fired and schools can be closed. That puts a lot of pressure on a 9-year-old. As Jess Clark reports, one Durham teacher is trying to get the scores up, and keep the anxiety down.
Third graders usually can't be counted on to remember important dates, other than their birthday. But Eastway third grader Antonio knows the exact dates of his end of grade tests, or EOGs.
Our two EOGs is May the 31st, and that's the reading one, then the math one is on June 1st.
Antonio says he really wants to pass them.
My stomach's nervous and everything. I have the BGs. That's the bubble goods.
I wouldn't also, be talking about also, it. I wouldn't be worrying about it. I would have been studying it.
Sage advice from his classmate, Shamoria. Their teacher is Turquoise Lejeune Parker, and like all the teachers at Eastway, she's under a lot of pressure to improve student test scores.
The state expects me to perform. And when I say me, I mean my kids. They expect my kids to perform, and they expect to see proficiency and growth.
Eastway got an F last year on its school report card. And while the school has made steady progress over the last couple years on improving test scores, less than 20% of its third graders tested at grade level in reading. Eastway is also a Title I school where most students come from low-income families. Some students are homeless, and many students come from immigrant families and are still learning English. Parker says the looming test does make her nervous, but in these last few weeks of school, she's trying to prepare her students without making them more anxious. She's also trying to keep her classroom exciting.
We need to review for the information that's going to be on the test, right? But I'm not getting ready to sit here and put packet after packet in their face. I can't stand a worksheet.
Instead, Parker turns over her classroom to computer engineer Osafo James. He breaks the kids into groups of four or five, gives each group a computer, and tells them to have at it. They're allowed to break it apart into its separate components.
You have the RAM out, you have this out, get the battery out.
Oh, I got it. No, I got it.
James isn't the only recent visitor to this classroom. In the past few weeks, Parker has brought in a college history professor, a city councilwoman, a lawyer, and a few others. Turning over her classroom to a visitor could be seen as a risky move for a teacher just 2 weeks out from her end of grade tests. But Parker doesn't see it that way.
All of these things that I'm exposing them to and giving them experiences, these are all things that connect to the standards.
Parker says exposing her kids to activities and ideas they've never encountered helps them build the connections and critical thinking skills they'll need to meet the state standards on the test. It also keeps them engaged and excited about school. Parker does have her students do some more traditional learning activities, like going over practice test questions in small groups.
Why do we look at the questions first?
Why we look at the questions? So when we read, we can go back in the story and answer it.
What does she do that's a part of
Parker says because her students face so many additional barriers, a big part of preparing for the end of grade test is building confidence. Her student Mary says it helps to know Mrs. Parker has her back.
And people say we're not smart. She says that we're smart. She always encourages us.
I tell them all the time, put your hands on your brain. Tell yourself, I am powerful, I am smart. In our morning meeting, I had them say, I'm creative, I'm gifted, I'm excited about my future, I'm a scholar. I'm having them say these things over themselves so they can believe it, and that this test on this one day does not determine who you are and what you're capable of.
1, 2, 3, I'm creative, I'm gifted, I'm excited about my future, I'm a leader, I'm a scholar.
Parker hopes that confidence will help students like Antonio avoid the bubble guts when they sit down for the big test next week. Parker will find out how well they did when their scores come back next fall, but whatever they turn out to be, she's already counting this year as a success.
Equity in Education was reported by Jess Clark and Lisa Phillip, thanks to funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can find more of the stories produced for this project at WUNC.org. I'm Dave DeWitt.